Bonjour, bonsoir. This is JCB Live, dear friends. And tonight, for this amazing happy hour, we're going to travel all the way to the United Kingdom. We're going to go and meet a wonderful, passionate, talented, first sommelier, and then incredible master of wine. His name is Alex Hunt. He started from Oxford. He was studying philosophy and psychology, and then realized, as the captain of the wine club of Oxford University, that wine was as interesting to trigger your mind and bring psychology and philosophy to your brain. He's a very talented man, works today for fantastic, important, and Berkman wine cellars, one of our great partners in the UK as well, who is promoting, obviously, the oldest, most historical winery, Buena Vista. He's been a contributed writer with Jancis Robinson, with the drinks business, and of course, Decanter Magazine. He has a fantastic accent, and you will hear all about the history of wine and the passion behind wine all the way from London. Alex, bonjour. Bonsoir, shall I say.
Bonsoir, Jean-Charles.
So in your honor, Alex, a little JCB 69. Woo! And just as a memory, Alex, from our wonderful time together at Annabelle's, do you remember that magical evening?
Yeah, that was great. That was just crazy. And
I thought I would bring you our latest decanter to carafe sparkling.
It's such a great idea. Why did you decide to design a carafe for sparkling?
Well, I'm sure you know the history as well as I do. You know, in the late 18th century, first of all, cheers.
Cheers. I need something in my glass. I don't have the fizz, but I've got some of your wine, so I'm going to jump the gun here so I can say
absolutely.
Cheers to you.
Cheers. Well, Alex, what happened is, you know, Marie Antoinette in the late 18th century, you know, basically 10 years before she went onto the Place de la Concorde to give her head to our museum, she really instituted carafing of sparkling because it was taking away some of the bubbles, making it softer, more gentle on the palate, and minimizing the size of the bubble. So it became a big trend in the 18th century in France, and then continued on, died a little bit by different leaders who instilled to the French tradition different ideas. And I thought it would be a great thing to start again as we produce so many great sparkling and champagne, that we have the ultimate vessel, as you could see, as a giant bubble, which is promoted at Harrods, in fact, and doing very well within the Baccarat shop in Harrods and many other great places in London. So you could see it there.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea to reintroduce that concept of carafing a sparkling wine. And I know it's counterintuitive for a lot of people because they think you have to do everything you possibly can to retain all the bubbles for as long as possible. But what I like about what you're doing there is that it kind of it reemphasizes the priority of a sparkling wine from the sparkling side to the wine side. So what you get, maybe at the expense of a few bubbles, is a much greater expression of the wine itself. And after all, it's a wine first and foremost. And this concept was first introduced to me actually by Champagne Jacasson, who I used to work for, representing in the UK when I started my career in wine 20 years ago. And they also had decanters, old decanters for champagne, and they would decant some of their vintage champagnes to serve with food, like a great Burgundy or something like this at the table. And it would be sparkling enough, and the wine would be amazing. And funnily enough, I don't know if you can see it on the piano there, there's the first bottle of Jacasson that I opened last night as the new distributor of Champagne Jacasson since this month at Berkman.
Congratulations.
So it all comes for full circle there.
Well, this is why we made it as a full circle, giant bubble. Following the egg shape of the bubble and, you know, the famous golden ratio, of course.
Of course. 1.618, the magic number.
You are so good. Most of the people tend to forget that part of, you know, math 101, but I think it's such an important one, isn't it?
It's so important. And, you know, you can find it everywhere in nature. I mean, you can't see, but I'm in my Victorian house in London, and the facade of the house, the architect, we had worked out that it's all plotted with the positioning of the windows versus the height of the stories. It's all done on golden ratio, which is just why it looks good. It looks right.
And it feels good as well. I know you're in your kitchen and it feels good.
It feels great. So it's a lot of truth in that.
Well, you know, so many people wonder why everybody is in front of Mona Lisa, whether she's a man or he's a man or she's a woman. We never know what the original intention was, but everybody, as they see that very small, but they totally optically, you know, stigmatized by the mouth and the eyes and the alignment, all the golden ratio again.
Right, exactly. It's amazing. I don't know why it works, but there we go.
Well, on that note, you know, we just introduced a wine that I cannot wait for you to taste. And maybe we should introduce it to your friends at the Master of Wine, because it's called Phi. And it was for Pythagore, and it was actually carved in the barrel first and foremost as the golden ratio. And this is actually one of the first ever barrel out of 23 years of work. This famous cooper, Le Grange, in France succeeded, and we made a wine out of it. And I think the wine has transcendental emotion.
Great. And what is the wine itself? What kind of wine have you put in that barrel?
We did a Cabernet Sauvignon, a JCB Cabernet Sauvignon number one. So you could taste the wine that has been aged in a traditional barrel, same time, and the Phi in the Phi barrel. And you know, I think together we should really do that exercise, because it's fascinating.
Great, bring it on.
Absolutely. So Alex, you studied at the famous Oxford University, one of the best on the planet. And you were studying philosophy, psychology. So from there, how do you move into the world of wine? How did that happen for you?
Well, at the time it felt like a bit of an accident, although I was spending a lot of my time outside my studies interested in wine, pursuing that interest. I'd been interested from my school days, or you know, high school, age 16, in wine. And by the time I got to university, I already thought it was really fascinating. And I just couldn't get enough of this concept that an amorphous liquid like this can represent places and people and ideas and times in history through vintages and so on. I couldn't stop reading about it. So, you know, when I put down my philosophy books or whatever, the next book I'd pick up would always be about wine. I got into the university club, as you mentioned, and we had some really amazing speakers come and present their wines to us. I mean, you know, we had Corinne Monsalopoulos from Margaux. We had Monsieur Delmas and Prince Robert of Aubryon. We had Véronique Drouin come and present Oregon and Burgundy side by side. Paul Draper from Ridge. Champagne Jacasson, that's how I first knew them. And even though at the time I had my heart set really on joining the music business, but going into record production, doing something along those lines, it sort of became more and more inevitable that actually wine would be the path I would follow. And those were the doors that opened. So I was very fortunate to get given an in to this industry, having fallen in love with it. And
so I've been here since. Could you say you follow your passion?
Oh yeah, totally. I really did. And I don't believe in fate or the stars aligning or anything, but let's say I believe in amusing coincidences that you can pretend a signpost encourage you. And even in my final exam, it was the module called Aesthetics and Theory of Criticism in the philosophy part of my degree. You had to choose three essays to write, and there were the normal sort of standard questions on music and literature and art and photography and all these things. And then one option at the bottom: can one wine ever be objectively better or worse than another? And I thought, my God, they've even given me a wine question. in my exam. And so I killed it. And at that point, alia iacta est, the die was cast.
Well, this is amazing. So I'm going to serve the Buena Vista that you have in your glass. And I'd love for you to answer to us that question that you had in your text. This is a tough one, though. Can wine be?
Yeah, can one wine ever be objectively better or worse than another?
Wow. And, so what would you answer to that one?
That's a big one. Well, I mean, the short answer is yes, it can. And that can sometimes be, on the face of it, a shocking answer to people, I think, because they would say, well, it's all subjective. We have different tastes. You and I have different preferences. We together might have different preferences from people who are not in the industry, or, you know, from a different culture or whatever it might be. And it's absolutely true that taste is, personal taste is a very important component of any aesthetic appreciation, wine included. But at the same time, there are certain objective, qua agreed standards that pertain to wine. And so all you have to do to answer the question is to take a really extreme example. And so let's say a wine that was truly great that I'd had shortly before that exam at one of these great tastings was Chateau Margaux 83, which is a hauntingly wonderful wine. And is agreed by really pretty much everyone who's tried it in good condition to be a wonderful wine. And let's say, we'll imagine a nameless plonk from the bargain bin of a local supermarket or cash and carry. What we have there is a dichotomy that really is an ostensive definition of what we mean by one wine being better or worse than another. And that's not to say anything more than that statement. It's not to say that someone ought to prefer the Chateau Margaux and that they're wrong if their personal taste leads them to the other wine.
That's
it's
right.
That they ought to buy the Chateau Margaux, even if they have the means to do so, or to serve it on a particular occasion. It may be that, you know, for a picnic, actually a wine in a squeezy plastic bottle that's very undemanding is a nicer thing to drink than Margaux 83. But all those are separate to the inherent quality of the wine. And the idea that a wine has an inherent quality that is at least semi-independent from our experience in the moment of drinking it on one particular day with one particular group of people in one particular place is, I think, actually fundamental to what we all do every day.
Wow, what a beautiful answer that I would have to fully agree as well to. Very well said. So you got an A+, right?
That was essentially it. And I've been sort of thinking about that topic ever since.
Well, but this is a great topic. And then you pursued, Alex, from this amazing studies of graduating at Oxford. You start in the wine trade, and then you decide to do your Master of Wine. So how was that really intense experience? Because this is the biggest exam in the world of wine.
Yeah, it was largely super positive. I decided that I went quite quickly from thinking, well, it seems very remote and an impossible mountain to scale, to thinking, you know what, I really ought to do this while my academic chops are still kind of in place. So I set out to do it as young as possible and get it done. So I enrolled in the program when I was 22, and I took the exam for the first time when I was 24. And I passed those exams, and the whole process was hard work, but it was amazingly stimulating, educating. I met fantastic people, friends still today. It was very, very positive. Then I had a little bit of a hiccup, because after you pass the exams, you have to do a what used to be called a dissertation, and it's now called a research project, but it's 10,000 words on an original topic. And I made a tactical error, because I decided to go deeper into this same question about objectivity and subjectivity in wine criticism. And I wrote a kind of philosophy piece on this. And it turned out that it didn't go down so well. but it didn't meet the criteria that were set at the time for this piece of work. And so, of course, I was very disappointed at the time and looked for a way out of this. And in the end, the way out of this was to pick another topic, also very close to my heart, which was California wine. Because it's one of my favorite places on earth, and I think the wines are richly misunderstood in many cases, but also have a very interesting recent history. So I studied the trends in ripeness in California over the last 40 years or so and found out what was going on and why the wines seem to be getting richer and riper, and what the future held on that particular topic. And that was the one that got me through. So finally in 2010, 8 years after I embarked on the program, I got the third component in place and got the coveted letters. And I think as much as I was upset at the hurdle at the time, I think becoming an MW at 30 maybe stands you in better stead than becoming an MW at 25 when you're a bit...
Well, you're probably one of the youngest... of all things, you're probably one of the youngest MW anyhow at 25.
Yeah, I mean, at 25, I would have been close to that. Though I think in the old days before the structure was it, as it is now, there were a couple of 24-year-olds who did it.
But, well, let's have a toast.
So no complaints. It worked
let's
out well.
Let's have a toast to that because even 30 is an amazing young age to achieve the famous master of wine. So we're very proud of you. So you got, as you love California wine, you love to describe, we'd love for you to describe this wine. Give us your master of wine process on how you taste wine.
All right, well, I don't know if this is gonna be official master of wine process or certainly not exam style process anymore, because it's great when you can leave that behind. But I think what I really like about this wine, is that it has a juxtaposition of seemingly contradictory attributes. And that sounds like a real pretentious jumble of long words. But what I mean by that is that it kind of resolves the impossible. So it's got a tension between brightness and smokiness and acidity and then richness. Or if you like, between a certain Burgundian ideal and the smokiness we find in new school, very desirable Meursault, naming no names. And then also the richness that you would look for in a California wine. And I think in that sense, it manages to be really true, both to a kind of theoretical ideal of good wine, but also true to its roots. And what we don't want to see in California or Australia or anywhere that has adopted grape varieties from Europe is a kind of copycat, an attempt to make a facsimile of those European styles. Because really, what's the point? You're doomed to fail to a greater or lesser degree because it's just a different place. It's a different terroir. And if we believe in terroir, which of course we do, then you're going to have different raw material and you want to express that to the best of its ability and of your ability. But at the same time, those blueprints coming out of the great vineyards of Europe are worth paying attention to. I mean, they're known and they're famous for a reason. And that's what I find here. It's super satisfying. I love drinking this wine, even just smelling it, because it's friendly, but it's not soppy. You know, it's comforting and inviting, but it also has some vigor to it.
Oh, I love how you describe the wines. And this was for everybody with us today, the famous Buena Vista Carneros Chardonnay. Reminder, it's the oldest winery in California. So that's so exciting. So well said, Alex. So on that note, give us the psychology of wine, of what makes your training as psychology into the world of wine. Because you use so many beautiful words and you bring such a great juxtaposition. Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, the psychology side is, to me, it's still a mystery, in fact. And when we say psychology in terms of my degree, it's really neuroscience. And there are a lot of very clever people looking at the sensory psychology and the neuroscience of taste and smell. I mean, Charles Spence is maybe the most famous professor at Oxford, who was working in the psychology department when I was there, and then became famous as Heston Blumenthal's kind of psychology guru.
Yeah.
These people have way more knowledge than I do of all the various psychological aspects. And I wish I had time to research them more. I think there are so many unexplored components to tasting, not least something as simple as the order of wines in a lineup. This is something that kind of scares me, because of course, as professionals, we always have to taste wines in long lineups and make judgments about them seemingly in isolation, but really affected by the wines either side. Now, one thing I've noticed particularly, if you have a wine that smells maybe a bit reduced, the next wine is more likely to seem a little oxidative in comparison, or vice versa, even if that next wine is actually completely dead center. And that alone suggests that maybe we need to refine the way we approach judging and tasting, have everyone taste in a different order, or taste each wine twice, jumbled up, or something like that. Because even if we allow for a certain component of objectivity in criticism, cumulatively, as we taste a wine again and again through our lives and our colleagues' lives in different countries and seeing the wine at different stages, I think we build up that picture because we're seeing the wine from a slightly different angle every time. You know, it's like those enormous telescope arrays that look into space, but it's not just one device. It's spread out across maybe an entire country or an entire continent, seeing space from just a slightly different angle each time. And that's how we build up an objective picture as much as possible of a wine. But when we look at it just once in a big lineup, it's really hard to say how complete a view we're getting of that wine. And so that's something that I would love someone with the time to do it, to research.
That would be a great, great research for sure. But as you taste, maybe, do you always use the same technique? And do you always bring your mind and your brain within the same place as you analyze wine? Or depending if it's red, champagne, or whites, you use a different approach?
I think I would certainly try always to use the same approach.
Okay.
And to look fundamentally for the same things when I taste a wine. And I think it's different if I'm tasting, I don't know, if I have a lineup of 30 samples that cost €2 to try and find, you know, a nice house wine is maybe a slightly different mental exercise to trying to do long prose critiques of very fine and complex wine. That is different psychologically, for sure.
Yes.
But I still think that at base, you're looking for quite similar things. And I mean, the first thing I look for if I'm evaluating a wine is deliciousness. It has to taste nice. It has to be yummy. And I think this is oddly an underrated component. Lots of the samples I get sent do not fulfill this criterion. You could call it, you know, the Coca-Cola test, if you like. You know, is this nicer than Coke? That's the first hurdle. Now, lots of wines are, but lots of wines aren't really. You know, and you know, here's a benchmark that's very standardized, that is, you know, perfected by many generations of people in labs to create a synthesized drink that is delicious. And if personally you don't like Coke, then you could choose another example, you know, orange juice or whatever. But that simple deliciousness, I think, is the first hurdle of any wine at any price level, and almost at any stage of evolution. Even if it's a young fine wine, it has to give some sense of being nice. And then after that, what you expect of the wine is maybe more determined by what it is, but some degree of complexity is nice, something that you have to go back and think twice. I think when wine is above a certain price and becomes more than just something to quench your thirst and stimulate your appetite over a meal, but an object of potential beauty or attention in itself. It's really important that it both captures and then holds and then merits that attention. And certainly if you're spending the same amount of money as you might on a ticket to a concert or the opera or the theater or a sport game, you know, you go and you're disappointed if your attention is not held by this event over the course of the evening. Well, I think it's the same for wine. It needs to be able to command your attention and then to reward that attention if you're spending theater ticket money on it. And I think we've seen a period, certainly in California, but in many other places in the world, where concentration became maybe the most rewarded aspect of a wine. And big wines that packed a lot of power were really seen as the top. That'd be like saying, I want to go to the loudest concert, or I want to read the novel that has the blackest text and the biggest letters. It's not really allowing you much in the way of nuance or content. I think, and this is to borrow a glib phrase I used in an article recently, we've gone from expecting wines that are concentrated to looking for wines that you can concentrate on. And ooh, I think that's a much more rewarding approach.
This is very so, well said, of course. And I love how you draw the parallel to music and the concerts, the loudness and the refinement. And I love how you build this parallel. When you taste wine, in fact, do you listen to music?
I don't. And this is another point, kind of from neuroscience, that we know that there's something called intersensory modulation, and this is the way the senses affect each other. And I love listening to music, and there are lots of things I can do while listening to music, but tasting wine is not one of them. I find it almost distressing because I can feel my concentration being pulled. After all, human beings are not terribly well equipped sensorily to taste wine. I mean, it's a real mental struggle that we have to overcome because we're not like dogs and cats. You know, we don't have such sensitive noses because we don't use those senses to build up a picture of the world. We generally don't recognize our friends by their smell. It's all by their face and the sound of their voice. And so being able to recognize these friends of ours by their smell and their taste is quite a hurdle. So if there's something more dominant going on, something auditory, interesting music, it's really, really hard for me to concentrate. And so I'll always try and avoid that. And also because I know it affects the way you perceive it. I've done this experiment again in California, tasting wines with different music playing. And it really genuinely affects not just your feeling about the wine, but the sensation of sugar, of tannin, of balance in the wine. And so that's just one further hurdle I don't want to have to overcome.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. We have, Alex, we work very closely with UC Davis, you know, the local university, very well known for wine, and a great psychologist, in fact, on wine and music. And we developed at the JCB Lounge a tasting, which is all about wine and music and how wine is being so influenced by music that it changes totally the way you could think about it. So the way we do the tasting is we give you a glass of wine, let's say Pinot Noir, and we play five different music, and you have to do five different intakes of the wine, and you write down your emotion as far as how you feel, if it's Beethoven, if it's Elvis Presley, Lady Gaga, Ray Charles, and maybe, you know, Elton John. And you would be so surprised, as I'm sure you've done the exercise already, how your preconceived ideas of maybe a romantic classical music is maybe not as good for Pino as Lady Gaga, or for that matter, Elvis Presley. And it's amazing because we do it for 8 to 12 people at a time, and we often get very similar reaction. Whether the people are experts in wine or not, everybody somehow goes into the same direction as far as the conclusion. Isn't it fascinating?
That's absolutely amazing, the way that something really, really abstract in one sense, music, which has no physical presence, but is something extended through time, like a code, can interact with something else that has a physical presence, but no temporal dimension.
That's
and
right.
Is another code. I mean, the brain is an amazing thing. And even just scratching the surface for a few years studying it is itself mind-blowing. I think Kant said something along the lines of, if the human brain was simple enough for us to understand it, we'd be too stupid to do so. So we're always trying to chase our tail, any idea what's going on. And long may that continue. So good for you researching it.
Well, as we're on that tangent, as maybe we serve the Buena Vista Cabernet or Pinot Noir, you have the Pinot Noir, right?
I've got both. So where should we do Pinot Noir?
Well, let's do Pinot Noir first.
Okay.
Which I've pre-poured. I haven't used that decanter yet because I thought it was very good, just fresh out of the bottle on this one. And maybe it would be interesting to show us the process of how you taste, to enlighten everybody, because a lot of our friends with us today, some are really much into the world of wine and some are getting into it. So it would be wonderful if you analyze the wine for us as you do it, as a master of wine and a major influencer in the world of wine.
No problem. So the first thing I do is, well, I have to pretend that I've got a piece of white paper here or something to look at the color against. But even as it is, you know, I can see that this wine, this is the 2014 vintage that I have here, this Carneros Pinot Noir. It's got this lovely pale color of Pinot, which is what I'd look for. Again, there was a period when people tried to make dark Pinot because dark was seen as more valid. Pinot doesn't really do that very well. So this has the lovely translucency of a true Pinot Noir and starting to go a little bit garnet at the edges, which is a sign of the evolution you'd expect of a wine that is 6 years old now. And then a little swirl, of course, which isn't just part of the signs that I know what I'm doing and I'm a wine person, so I have to do this, even though it does become habitual after a while and you catch yourself doing
it. Yeah, you do it with water after a while, I've noticed. Oh, orange juice. Oh,
let me think like that. Yeah, yeah. But in this case, it's going to open up this lovely aroma. And here what I'm finding is a bit like the color. The nose is consistent, so we're getting a sense of wine that's on a journey because it's still got fruit flavors, characteristic of Pinot, very much red sort of fruit, cherries and strawberries and raspberries and all these lovely things, which I adore. But it's also got what we call the tertiary characteristics, the characters of an older wine coming through, which add to the complexity. So it's more like undergrowth or clean mushrooms or, you know, the forest floor, you know, these kind of, or what we'd call sous-bois in Burgundy, which is really great. And as an aside, I mean, this leads to another of the magic things of wine, that you can have a list of smells that have no right to go together, that sound really horrible and you wouldn't actually want to eat. And yet through the magic of wine, they become not just delicious, but a harmonious whole that is greater than the sum of the parts. And you could say the same thing, I don't know, about an Hermitage or another great Syrah. You know, imagine if someone gave you a drink, like a smoothie made of black olives, blackberries, infused with smoke, bacon fat, leather, and made a smoothie out of that. I mean, it would be so disgusting. And yet this Hermitage has all those flavors. I mean, they're all there, and yet it tastes transcendentally fantastic. That's part of the magic trick. So we've got some
That's the magic of wine.
It really is. It makes the impossible possible. And it makes the impossible delicious. That's the important bit.
So you move the wine all around your palates, of course.
All around. Again, just trying to capture it from every angle in a way and to get a sense of the texture. Texture, I think, is another component of wine that can be sometimes overlooked. And maybe more than picking out 100 different flavors is what helps separate really good wine from ordinary wine. A sense of a presence in the mouth while yielding aroma. And I don't quite mean the same as body, because that would suggest the fuller the body, the better the wine. And I don't mean that. But a texture that is evocative, even if it's light as silk, or whether it's robust as maybe this Napa wine will prove to be. You want more than just a flavor component, because then otherwise you have flavored water in a sense. You
That's
need,
right.
Of course, some of that alcohol to give the feel. You need the tannin to be just right, and the tannin here is lovely. It gives a little bit of grip and a little bit of dryness around the cheeks and on the tongue, but not too much. And to me, the tannin and the acid of a wine, which with the alcohol out together, I would call the structure. They're a bit like the frame of a painting. If the flavor is the painting, and that's really what we're looking into, it needs the right frame, not just any old frame. It could be too big, too delicate, the wrong color, but the right frame sets off the picture perfectly. And here you want the harmony between the structure and the flavor. And this wine certainly has it. It's very, very fine. And I would use this as an example to challenge anyone who makes the mistake, which is quite common in the UK, of thinking that all California wine is super rich and heavy and maybe very oaky or very extracted or very powerful, very alcoholic, whatever it might be. This is the caricature. And those wines exist. Of course they do. But not all California wine is like that. And responsible importers who love California wine, such as ourselves, make a point of selecting the wines that have finesse, that we think that people looking for these characteristics in a European market will appreciate that finesse. And so we try to overturn some of those myths. This is a great wine to do it, because it does have that Burgundian sense of delicacy without trying to taste like Burgundy. It tastes of Carneros, but it's made pure. I love it.
Well, you describe it so well. What a painting you've drawn for all of us. Now, Alex, what would you recommend to someone who tastes wine for the first time? What to do with this intimidating glass of wine in front of them, just to make it phenomenal and to use their brain just to escape?
I think the best thing you can do starting out, and this is really the light bulb moment that I had when I was a kid, is to have two wines of the same color side by side.
Okay.
It sounds super simple, but in fact, it's not normally how we do things. You open a bottle of wine and you finish it, with your partner, your friends, whatever, and maybe then you have another bottle, maybe of the same wine or something different afterwards. But the real magic of wine, and the reason it becomes a lifelong passion and occupation for all of us, is that wines are different from one another, and they're different for a reason as well. So my light bulb moment was having two white wines from France, and I still remember, this is 24 years ago, and it was a Chardonnay from Languedoc and it was a Muscadet. So same price, same country, same color, same maturity, so much the same. But of course, they tasted completely different. And even as a total novice, I could see. Whereas if I'd had one on Friday and one on Saturday, I don't think that difference would have been at all clear, because I wouldn't have built up any memory for flavor in wine whatsoever. You have to do it side by side. And then, and this is kind of level two geek, I had a book in front of me as well. In fact, I had two books, I think, that we got at the same time as the wine. And one was Oz Clark's Pocket Wine Guide, and the other was Jancis Robinson's Wine Course. And this was the real magic, that not only were these two wines different, but the difference was predicted by these people who wrote the books. Well, how is that possible? How can they know already why I'm going to have a different experience right here. This is crazy. And now I know the reason, which is that the wines are different, not for some kind of random event, but because they are expressive of different varieties and places. But this was a concept that was completely alien to me as a novice. And is fundamental, I think, to enjoyment of wine, that we have a delicious beverage that has the capacity, I think, more than any other, to tell a story. And here I was being guided as to what the story was. And I never stopped.
Amazing. Great experience. I recommend everybody should do that. And I think you picked two wines which really are on that side of the extremes, you know, the South of France Chardonnay and the Muscadet. I mean, very interesting exercise. I'm going to start to play with this with people who are not tasting much, but I think it's a great way to really understand what wine is all about. I fully agree. So now, tell us about the last wine, Alex, the Cabernet Sauvignon, and your view as your thesis you did on rightness, which would be quite fascinating to discuss, and maybe what is rightness? And within this context, how do we find it, and what's the pleasure of it or the unpleasant side of it, and so forth?
Sure. Let's look at the wine first. So again, 2014 vintage, Napa Cabernet. Napa, of course, being one of the world's great zones, great terroirs, or set of terroirs for Cabernet Sauvignon, and really found a second home there. And in the 60s, if not earlier, maybe in the 50s, it was starting to get established. And now, of course, it's synonymous. I mean, everyone who has some wine knowledge associates Cabernet with Napa Valley now, I think. And you can see why, because I think it's a wine that very openly expresses a kind of luxury, with a certain class. Cabernet for me really is about class and proportion. And I kind of think of it in terms of architecture. Pinot is like a wild meadow. Cabernet is like a Georgian townhouse, all symmetry. Back to the golden ratio. You know, I'm not looking for golden ratio stuff in Pinot Noir. I'm looking for something, you know, loose and creative and seductive and whatever. But yeah. Cabernet, the perfection of the structure, is all there. And so you want to see that. But again, we're not in Bordeaux here. You want maybe a little bit more flesh and more amplitude. And this already smells really lovely because it has a sort of, it is very ripe. It has a Kirsch-like ripeness. And it was a great question you asked just now, very, very complex question of what is ripeness. But before we get even close to the sort of the science of that or different ways that winemakers measure ripeness, I think there are maybe two ways that we can categorize high ripeness in terms of how they smell and taste. And one of them is raisins. You know, it's dried fruit, something that's gone too far for me, that smells of a fruit that is desiccated.
Yeah,
and not in a good way, that sometimes you get a candy peel or dried fruit in an old sherry or something like that. I mean, that's magic. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about a wine that is relatively young and you know, it made in a conventional way like this, that would have this kind of brown, tired feel, like it's been picked too late, like fruit has been picked too late. You find lots of examples of that. This is not one of those. I hasten to add, this is the other kind, where the ripeness is still up. It's the opposite of shriveled. It's a plump ripeness, you know, of fruit that is bursting with juice, rather than where the juice has dried out a bit. And so it's a very fruity smell, but not in a kind of bonbon way. This is just ripe currants and plums. And there's some oak here. You get a little bit of vanilla and spice, but it's really quite subtle. You know, that's oak as frame rather than oak as central part of the painting. And I like that a lot better than a wine that really shows off its oak.
We don't want to suck as a lollipop, just an oak barrel in the wine. Yeah. That would be tragic.
that's not nice, and it doesn't taste nice. And also, oak contributes tannin, and that's often not very pleasant and not very necessary for a wine like Cabernet Sauvignon that has its own wonderful tannin structure. Why would you want to mess around with that? So this is already encouraging. I don't think we'll find any of that here. I mean, that's really beautiful. And I should mention as well, these came up from the cellar about an hour ago. Mm. So this bottle is maybe 16, 17 degrees. And I like that a lot. I think we always say red wine should be served at room temperature, but that rule was in place before central heating. So room temperature was not 20, 22 or whatever it is in Fahrenheit. It was cooler than that. It was the room temperature of an unheated English house, probably.
That's right. We need to bring it back to today's time.
It's a different thing. So this is just slightly cool. And that helps give it this fantastic frame of structure. And I really like, again, the precision of that ripe fruit. It's juicy, but it's not chaotic. And the structure is just framing it in a really nice way, because I can feel the acidity. I can feel the tannin, but it's supportive. It doesn't dominate or dry the mouth. And I'm looking on the back, and here it says 15% alcohol. Yeah. And that sounds like a lot. And of course, that will have a physical effect if you choose to drink a large quantity of this wine. But aesthetically, it is absolutely not to the wine's detriment. This is not an over-alcoholic wine. And by that, I mean, I can't taste the alcohol.
That's it. And that's what we want to avoid.
I'd notice it if it weren't there, but I don't get that feeling, you're coming through your nose like you've just had a shot of vodka, which in some wines you can have. Even at supposedly lower levels than this, you can get that feeling because they're not balanced and there's not enough flavor to mask that effect. But here the flavor is so good and the balance is so good, you don't see that alcohol at all.
Did an amazing job, and I'm sure everybody is drinking wine now or tasting wine or looking at wine in a very different way, because you've been bringing philosophy, psychology, humanity, and a lot of excitement in how you describe and frame your wines. And I love your description of Pinot as more this wild, you know, and then Cabernet as more this architectural monument. I think this was very well said. So Alex, as one of our final moments, what would be your big message to everyone who wants to love wine more, who wants to appreciate wine more from your perspective as a master of wine, and today one of the most amazing experts of fine wine in the world?
I think the big message is have the courage of your convictions, but stay open-minded. Never stop learning, but know that your opinion counts. And ultimately, it's about deriving pleasure. Pleasure of the senses, pleasure of the intellect, pleasure of the company and the discovery and the gastronomy that goes with it. That's really what it's about. And to explore, never stop exploring, because there's a whole world out there, and a world that, just like the world of the academic, is evolving every year. Only this time it's a little less dry. So just enjoy it and keep on exploring.
I love it. So I have two glasses, two hands, God gave me. So I'm going to hold the two glass and keep exploring the Pinot and the Cabernet. And Alex, I want to thank you so much for being part today of the JCB Live, because it was such a phenomenal exploration. And I want to remind you, I had another 20 questions for you. But can you believe we've been 45 minutes together, and it has been such a great intellectual journey, such an analytical journey of the mind and the brain. I think everybody is going to think differently about wine after listening to you. So thank you immensely for such a great time.
Thank you, JCB. And if you've got more questions, let's do this again. It's been great. Absolutely. It's always a pleasure to see you.
We got to do it. Cheers.